in. And we want to begin our lesson here tonight in Micah chapter 1. We had looked at the first four verses of this, and we're still pretty much along the same line there. When we begin, especially there from about verse 3 on down to 7, we saw the judgment that God was going to bring upon Samaria and upon Jerusalem and upon the lands that these two towns were the capital of. And when we come to our first verse tonight, verse 5, we discover the cause of this judgment. Why will God bring this awful judgment mentioned there in verse 3 and 4 upon the house of Israel, upon these children of Jacob? The reason is given there in verse 5, the cause of the judgment. For the transgression of Jacob is all of this, and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? And while these statements are more or less in the form of a question in the latter part, he's answering his own question. In a manner of speaking, there is one thing that is very evident when you first read this verse, and that is that any time that a nation or a people becomes steeped in sin, that it is the policy of God to bring judgment upon them. So the judgment that we're reading about here was a judgment coming from a righteous God, coming because of their sins, because of their transgressions. So judgment is oftentimes owing to sin. And here's proof of it. Now when the Lord actually brings the judgment upon him, which is mentioned in the book of Isaiah, the 10th chapter, when he's bringing here the king of Assyria against him, in verse 5 and 6 of Isaiah 10, you can see that God in his wrath is judging his people. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, and the staff in their hand is my indignation. In other words, he uses the nation of Assyria to punish the people that are the descendants of Jacob. I will send him against a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread down like the mire of the street. And so the devastation of that Assyrian invader is certainly indicated there, and it is said to be the very wrath of God against his people. And the wrath is there because of their sins and their transgressions. Now it says, therefore, the transgression of Jacob is all this. What is the meaning of that, all of this there? Well, the manifestation of God's wrath that was described back up there in verse 3 and 4 that even involved maybe volcanic eruption for all that we know. So sin would lay waste Samaria and Jerusalem. And sin really is the cause of ruin, whether it be material or moral. A lot of times people say, well, what's wrong with the world? To hear these liberals talk, you'd think it's the right-wing extremists. And to hear the extremists, as they call them, talk, you'd think that the trouble is a liberal. In fact, the real trouble is sin. That's the trouble with any nation. Another thing we might note in this, that external privileges and profession do not secure a sinful people from the judgment of God. These were God's covenant people, but they had sinned and God would punish them. Now he talks there about the house of Israel, and probably in the first part of that verse, it's certainly true of the whole 12 tribes, if you want to be technical, they were all the house of Israel or the descendants of Jacob. Jacob's other name was Israel. But probably there it just refers to the 10 northern tribes, the way that it is constructed. It talks about Samaria, and that of course is the capital of the northern kingdom, and it is the source of all the evil that has come upon the land of the tribes to the north, Israel there. I did a little time today trying to figure out just who built this city of Samaria? I asked myself that question. And let's go back and get a little history on this city of Samaria, which is the capital of the northern kingdom. It was built by Omri, one of the most wicked men that ever lived. And he had a son that wasn't any better. His name was Ahab, who married the notable Jezebel. If you go back to 1 Kings, the 16th chapter, and begin at verse 23, you can get some history here of how this city of Samaria was built. In other words, it was a sinful town from the beginning. It never improved. And in the 30th and first year of Ahaz, king of Judah, began Omri to reign over Israel. 12 years, 6 years reigned he in Tirzah, and he bought the hill of Samaria of Shemer for 2 talents of silver, and built on the hill, and called the name of the city which he built after the name of Shemer, owner of the hill, Samaria. So Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom, was built by Omri. And he goes on to describe what kind of character he was there in verse 25. But Omri wrought evil in the eyes of the Lord, and did worse than all that were before him. And he walked in all the ways of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and in his sin wherewith he made Israel to sin, to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger with their verities. So this capital of the northern kingdom was built by Omri, one of the most wicked kings that ever lived. And he was followed by his son, who was named Ahab. And Ahab, according to that same chapter down in verse 32, actually built a temple to Baal there in the city of Samaria. So it was a center of pagan worship, though it was supposed to be a people who believed in only one God. And yet they were worshiping many gods. And then he goes on after that there to talk about the corruption that not only is in Samaria, the northern kingdom, but he goes on down and he talks about what is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? Now he mentions these high places again. And always in the Bible, when it speaks of high places, that's shrines for idol gods, at least an altar of some kind built to an idol god. Now they were erected in the high places upon high hills and mountains, because they believe that that's where the gods dwell. And somehow in almost all the ancient nations, there was the idea that the gods were above. The Greeks said they were on Mount Olympus. And the Indians said the Great Spirit was somewhere up in the sky, you know. So everybody had the idea that God or the gods were at least up in high places. And so whenever they would sacrifice to the gods, if they were up on a high hill or up on a mountain, they thought the gods could see it better. And so that's why they made these shrines upon the high places of Judah. And of course, Jerusalem there is mentioned by name, and that is the capital of Judah, or the southern kingdom, as we call it. And Judah has become a very wicked place, very much like Samaria. There's actually not very much difference between the two. Now bear in mind that Micah, back in verse 1 and 1 there, is preaching during the time of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Now what happened in Judah, for instance, just during the reign of this fellow that was called Ahaz? Well, I want to give you an example. I'll let you know what's going on here. Go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 28. And I'll show you what awful things were going on there in the city of Jerusalem. And there were these high places exactly like they're describing. Terrible, terrible things were going on. In 2 Chronicles 28, look at verse 22 to 25. And in the time of his distress did he trespass yet more against the Lord. This is that king Ahaz. Now that's one of the kings of Judah that lived in the time of our prophet Micah. For he sacrificed unto the gods of Damascus. That's idol gods, heathen gods, which smote him. And he said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, therefore will I sacrifice to them, that they may help me. But they were the ruin of him and of all Israel. Now look here how sacrilegious this fellow was. And Ahaz gathered together the vessels of the house of God. That's in the temple. And cut in pieces the vessels of the house of God and shut up the doors of the house of the Lord. In other words, he closed down the church. Bolted up the door. And he made him altars in every corner of Jerusalem. In other words, he closed up the true worship of God, opened up false churches all over the town. That's putting it in a manner of speaking there. And in every several city of Judah, he made high places to burn incense unto other gods and provoke to anger the Lord God of his fathers. So if you want me to put it simple and plain, throughout the northern kingdom, all the way down to the southern kingdom in the days of Micah, there was a little bit left of the worship of the true God, but in the main they engaged in the worship of the golden calf, and they usually called him Baal, though they had other names for him from time to time. Now remember that Baalism is the primary religion that brought the ruin of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And if you'll read the book of Revelation, you'll find that Baalism will be the ruin of New Testament churches. The very same religion. And it's a false religion. That's another sermon and another story. Well, let's go on down and continue to study here, because we do want to cover more verses tonight than we did the last time. Let's go on down there to the sixth verse. We've seen the cause of judgment there in verse 5. And in verse 6, we have a description of the city of Samaria and how it's going to be destroyed. And this all happened, no doubt, from the hand of God, but he was using the Assyrian soldiers, the invaders, to do it. Probably Sennacherib and his soldiers, though Sargon may have been involved in some of it too. Sargon was the father of Sennacherib, and so they all were coming in there about the same time when a lot of this happened, and it's somewhat difficult to tell just which king was doing what sometime. Anyway, in verse 6, therefore I will make Samaria as a heap of the field and as the planting of a vineyard. And I will pour down the stones thereof into the valley, and I will discover the foundations thereof. He's speaking here now about the destruction of the city of Samaria, which was the capital of the northern kingdom. We've already learned there from 1 Kings 16 and 24 that the city of Samaria was what? Built on top of a hill. It was a high place itself. And all the way around this hill was a beautiful green valley, like often was the case in that land over there. One of the descriptions of Samaria in the book of Isaiah I found rather interesting in the 28th chapter, verse 1 to 4. Isaiah describes the city of Samaria as a reef on the head of a drunkard. And so the reef that he's talking about is that beautiful city sitting up there on top of this hill. It's like a beautiful reef of flowers put up on the head of a person. That's why he called it a reef upon the head of a drunkard. They were so drunken with idolatry until he compared them to a drunkard there. Though I'm sure they were probably getting drunk with wine and other things as well. That probably was going on too. But he says they're going to be reduced there to the heap of the field. And what that is, it's like a heap of stones gathered out of a cultivated field. Having lived in Kentucky and Ohio, I know something about gathering rocks out of the field. Every year it seemed like there's new ones that wasn't there the year before, and you'd gather them all out. Next year you'd plow again, be another crop of rocks have to be moved out. Where they all came from was always a mystery to me. I've asked people that live there, and they didn't have any explanation for it. How they just keep coming back, and seemed like you'd tote them all out, and they'd all be back then the next year for some reason. But he's saying that this beautiful city, this capital of Samaria, is going to look like just a heap of stones that'll be gathered out of a cultivated field. And so its slopes would lose their urban character and be cultivated as vine terraces. That's what he talks about and as the planting of the vineyard. In other words, there won't be any city there. All will be up there. It'll just be vines growing on the hillside and a few other things. There won't even be a town left there. Then he says, I will pour down stones thereof into the valley. Well, the Assyrian soldiers tore that city down, didn't leave one stone upon another one, and they rolled every one of them down the hill. Down the hill they went. And I'm told by the archaeologists that if you go over there now, you can still see those stones down in the Green Valley. They're still there. That city has never been rebuilt. And it made it very hard for the archaeologists to find it. But anyway, they found it, and all of those beautiful white stones are glowing out there in the green valley below, because they were all rolled down the hill, exactly like Micah warned was going to take place there. Then he talks about discovering the foundations there. And what that simply means is that when they got through destroying the city, rolling all of the stones from the wall in the city all down the hill, there'd be nothing left. It would be as if there had never been a city up on top of that mountain. There'd be no trace of the city left. Let me say something. Whatever is built without God, whether it is a nation or a city or a church, and cemented by sin, will be hurled down by God's judgment. That's a practical point there. Then we come down to verse 7, and we find that God is not only going to judge the inhabitants, not only going to judge the city, but he's also going to judge the false gods. And all the graven images thereof shall be beaten to pieces. And all the hearths thereof shall be burned with the fire. And all the idols thereof will I lay desolate. For she gathered it of the har of an harlot. And they shall return to the har of an harlot. And that verse deserves a lot of explanation because it has a lot of things in it there. First of all, some of the idols may have been stone. If so, they took a hammer and demolished them. They were beaten to pieces. Some of them were probably made out of metal, maybe silver or gold, valuable metal. Well, it was always the custom of the army that invaded a town. In other words, if the Assyrians came and they invaded Samaria, that they would literally demolish all the gods that they had. They'd beat them all to pieces. Now, they weren't going to throw all that gold and silver away. That'd never do. And so what they'd do, they'd totally beat the form of that god out of existence. I mean, they'd literally just obliterate the form of it. But they would take the gold and the silver with them. They'd go back home to their country. And then they'd make new idols out of them. And then they would take the idols like of the Israelites and turn them into the idols of the Assyrians. But they wouldn't take them back in the form they were in, because that would be looking up to the gods of Israel. And so what they'd do, they'd destroy the gods, they'd take them home, turn them into new gods and all of that. And that's what, in other words, the invading soldiers would carry off and recycle these idol gods and use them again in idolatrous worship. And that's what he means there in the statement there. All the graven images shall be beaten to pieces. Then he talks about in all the hars thereof. And still further down there he says the har of an harlot. And it shall return to the har of a harlot. There is a very bad custom that existed in the worshipers of Baal that I must really bring out in this lesson if that's going to make any sense. First of all, any time that the Israelites, who were God's chosen people, would take their money and use that money for false worship, that was considered spiritual fornication. In other words, if you mix false worship and true worship, that's idolatry, or it's spiritual fornication. And so it would be playing the whore spiritually. And so that's why it speaks there about the hire of an harlot. But worse than any of that, there was another custom that went on. In all of these places where they worshiped Baal, there was hard male and female prostitutes. Both kinds, not just one, I stress that. And the people would go there and engage in sexual immorality with the idea that Baal would bless them if they did that. Well, that sounds stupid. Why would anybody want to do anything like that? Well, idolatry never has made a lot of sense to me. But anyway, what it amounted to, Baal was a god of fertility. He was a god of fertility. They thought that he was the one that gave birth to all the babies that they had. And he was the one that gave an abundance to all the crops. In other words, if you had a good crop, Baal had blessed you and all of that. And they also thought that if you had a lot of flocks, you had a lot of cows, had a lot of sheep and all that, that it was because of the blessings of Baal. And so if you wanted to get Baal's favor, then you went to the place where he was worshipped, his altar, his temple, and the like, And there they would get involved in this sexual impurity with the idea that it would bring the blessings of Baal upon them. And I sometimes think that a lot of the sexual immorality of our day and time is nothing more than an offshoot of the Baalism in the Old Testament. I think that's all it is just bringing back that devil worship. And people don't really know what they're doing sometimes, but that's about what it amounts to. And so what was so terrible about all of this was that the Israelites were supposed to be worshiping the Lord God, the true God, but in fact they were not worshiping the God of heaven at all. They were worshiping Him under the form of Baal, a false god. And so they had what I'd call a mongrel religion. I guess they must have gone to church saying something like this, good Lord and good devil. Because they were worshiping God and they were worshiping the devil all at the same time. And remember that the Lord will not allow anybody to worship a false god. That's prohibited in the first and second commandment. And so it was a terrible thing. But you say, well, I want to know when it says there, she gathered it as the hire of a harlot. Well, offering style gods are harlot gifts, according to Isaiah 23:17 and Ezekiel 16:31. So in other words, they had paid their money out to idol gods. Therefore, all this gold and silver that they had paid out to the idol gods, to the harlot, they would go into the hands of the Assyrians and they'd build them gods, and so there'd be more harlot worship going on. It is remarkable in the Bible that whenever the Lord describes the false church, the world church of the end time, in Revelation chapter 17, He calls her the great whore. Because false worship is spiritual whoredom. It's spiritual prostitution, or whatever you want to call it. Well, let's pass on now, and we're going now to verse 8 and verse 9, and we're going into a new section here because Micah is going to mourn over the incurable wounds of divine judgment upon Israel and Judah. So, well, he's told them what was going to happen, yes, but he didn't enjoy preaching that sermon. Who would enjoy preaching the destruction of their nation? I mean, he lived in Judah. He's talking about his country. And when he was talking about the northern tribes, he is talking about his relatives. So it wasn't an easy job that this prophet had. And he was deeply moved and deeply touched by his own message. Therefore, I will wail and howl. I will go stripped and naked. I will make a wailing like the dragons and mourning as the owls. And he's talking here about the incurable wounds of judgment now. And he's not happy to preach that, but it is the truth, and he had to preach it unto the people. When he says, I will wail, in the Hebrew it literally means to beat the breast. To beat the breast. And so he would beat his breast, and he would cry. He would use all the acts of showing grief that was known to him to let the people know that he too was grieved because of this coming judgment. And then some have made a great deal of the statement there, strip naked, and people have the idea he'd run around there without his drawers on, up and down the town, all that preaching. Well, that wasn't quite the way it was. You got to understand how the Jews dressed and what they meant. The Jews wore two garments, like they had the inner garment, they had the outer garment. And if you took off the outer garment, they considered you half naked. And so quite often they would speak of it as being naked, though you weren't completely naked. You had on I guess what we'd used to call the long johns. Or you had on your nightgown in the case of the ladies. That's what it would amount to. You wouldn't properly attired, but you wouldn't stark naked either, as we think of it. Now, I'll show you that's what it means in the Bible. Go here to the book of Isaiah. Remember that Isaiah and Micah lived at the same time. And so whatever you find in one is pretty well describing the time of the other there. In the 20th chapter of Isaiah, verse 2 and 3. At the same time spake the Lord by Isaiah the son of Amos, saying, go and loose the sackcloth from off thy loins, and put off thy shoes from thy feet. And he did so, walking naked and barefooted. But now all he's done really is taken off the outer garment, and he's taken his shoes off. So the prophet's going around in what we might call his night clothes. He's not going around, as we'd say today, stark naked. He was half naked, would be the best way to express it. The Jews called it because you had the outer garment off, but you still had the inner garment on. And then there's mention of two creatures here. And I always enjoy digging into what these animals are in the Bible. Sometimes they tried to translate them so we could understand. But I think they probably should have translated it and left it to be the animal that it really was over there, because that's what made sense to the people and probably ought to make sense to us. He speaks there of howling and making noise like an animal. He said, I will make a wailing like the dragons. Well, he's not talking about these big old fiery dragons, you know, that breathe fire and all of that. Actually, it's the word there for jackal. Have you ever heard a jackal howl? They show a lot of these films of nature sometime on television. Jackals and hyenas and all that, when they howl, what an awful noise they make. It's a pitiful sound. It almost raises your hair on your head to listen at them. Well, it was an animal something like that. It's mentioned in Malachi 1 and 3 and Job 30 and verse 29. It's really a jackal. It was a jackal. And he would make a sound like a long plaintive howl of the jackal in the night. And then he talks about as the owls, and there were some owls of Palestine, though most Hebrew scholars do not believe the reference there is to the owl. They believe that it is to the ostrich, the old bird. The ostrich, he runs around, and if you take away the young, I understand the mama makes an awful noise. And they tell me you've never heard the noise they can make if you take away one of their young. And so it seems to me what he's saying is, I'm going to howl like the jackal. I'm going to cry out with the plaintive cry of an ostrich that has been bereaved of its young. I'm going to cry and weep and howl up and down the streets until everybody will look upon me as a mourner. And so, he would lament the suffering of the saints, but he would also lament the punishment of sinners. I don't think we ought to take any pleasure in the suffering of the saints or in the punishment of sinners. Micah didn't. I don't believe many other characters in the Bible did. I was thinking about different ones, like Isaiah, living at the same time. He had to preach a sermon about like Micah most of the time. Go read his book. But you know, he was grieved over what he had to preach, because in Isaiah 22 and verse 4 he said, therefore said I, look away from me, I will weep bitterly. Labor not to comfort me because of the spoiling of the daughter of my people. He was grieved. Jeremiah, living also not so very far removed from these days, said in chapter 9 of his prophecy, in verse 1, oh, that my head were waters, and mine eyes as a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughters of my people. They didn't call him the weeping prophet for nothing. The Apostle Paul in Philippians 3 and 18 talked about the people, the false teachers that were enemies of the cross of Christ. But he said, I tell you about them weeping. He didn't take pleasure in talking about heretics even. He was grieved for them because they were ignorant and in the dark. So I suppose the great message here that we learn in Micah is that ministers ought to be affected with the message that they deliver to others. If they don't feel it in their own heart, then it's not going to make any impression on your heart when you hear it. Never forget what was said about one preacher in the 1800s. A fellow went to hear him preach that didn't even believe in God. Matter of fact, he was an infidel, and they asked him, said, well, why do you go? He said, you don't believe in God, you don't believe in the Bible, you don't believe in the church, why do you go? He said, I like to hear a man preach that believes what he preaches. So while he didn't believe what he preached, he was convinced that the man doing the preaching did believe what he preached. And so he liked to hear a man that seemed to be sure about what he had to say, a man that was affected with the message that he delivered to other people. Then we come on down here and we see the awful incurable wound there in verse 9. For her wound is incurable. For it is come unto Judah. He has come unto the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. The judgment starts in the northern kingdom. It'll sweep all the way down to the south before God's through. You know, the wound inflicted on Samaria was incurable. And no hand can cure the wound that God inflicts. If God punishes a man, who's going to stop it? And so he said, the judgment that is here now in Samaria, it'll pass on down to the south. It'll come to my country, to my own town, my own capital. And we're all going to be ruined before it's over with. And so this terrible state of things was coming, and the prophet was very grieved because of it. He said it is an incurable wound, and there's no remedy for the present state of things. I think about before the fall of Judah that is described there in the latter chapters of 2 Chronicles. It tells about how they rebelled against the prophets and how they built all these idol gods, and it goes on to say, and there was no remedy. Well, Micah didn't see any remedy either. And then I want you to look at that statement there when it says, He is come unto the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. And that, of course, is the enemy that's going to inflict these wounds, probably Sennacherib. And then, of course, the final judgment of Judah that will take place under Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, in its final form. And then we get into the next section here, and it's a beautiful section in the Hebrew. It is not so easily seen in our English version, and so I'm going to have to kind of make a word play for you to get the word play that the prophet made here. He put forth some beautiful language, beautiful sayings that are somewhat difficult to bring out in English, but we're going to do what we can to help you to understand this. And a lot of scholars say this is the most difficult part of the book because of the word play on the town names that he mentions here. And a lot of these places were all near him, or not too far from him, if you look at the map. And so they were towns that he knew about. They were not so far removed from him. And when we get down to the 10th verse, there's going to be three towns, though the name of one is not seen so clearly in our version. There is a name of Gath, Anko, and Aphra in that 10th verse. Declare it not at Gath. Weep ye not at all in the house of Aphra. Roll thyself in the dust. Well, I said there was a play on words here, so let's go back to that. Declare it not at Gath. If you look at the map and study the Bible, like 2 Samuel 1 and 20 and other places, you'll find that Gath was a city of the Philistines. The city of the Philistines that was near to where Micah lived, not too far from him, but some distance too. Now this word Gath means tail town, T-E-L-L, then you hyphenate it, T-O-W-N, tail town. I don't know of any, I think I've been to some places I thought was a little bit like that. We'd call it gossip town today, or backbiting town or something like that. And if we put it over in modern English, it would read like this. In tell town, tell it not. Or I guess if you wanted to put it in more modern English, you could say, don't tell it over there in tattletown. All the people over there are a bunch of tattletales, and if you tell it over there, they'll all tell everybody about it. And we don't want anybody to know about the awful judgment that God's going to send upon us. So tell it not at Gath. Don't tell it in gossip town. If you do, everybody will know about it. And that's what he said. Now the next expression there, weep ye not at all. John Gill and other scholars point out that many would translate there this word Anko. A-C-C-O is the way it's spelled. It's sometimes spelled different. But what he's pointing out is that the grief that's going to come upon Israel and Judah, you don't need to spread it far and wide. Don't tell everybody about how God has judged us, because we don't want the news to get out. It's so awful. Nobody should know about it. When he said, weep not at all, it means to weep in silence. Or if you're going to have tears, then go hide out and don't let anybody see you when you cry. Don't let the enemy know how grieved you are. Don't let him know how you're upset. But now, a lot of people would read it like this in the Hebrew. In Ankho, weep not. And if you want to put the real meaning in Weep Town, weep not, so that these foreigners will know how bad the thing is. That town spelled differently in Judges 1:31, but it's probably the same town over there. It was in one of the tribes of Israel and Judah there, if you look at it. And then in the latter part there, you have this Aphra said, in the house of Aphra, roll thyself in the dust. And probably the full name of that town is Beth-Leel Aphra. And it means the house of dust. Or if you want to put it this way, dust town. D-U-S-T-8-T-O-W-N, dust town. So he calls Aphra here, he's altering the word there a little bit. It's spelled a little differently in other places, but he's altered it to make it mean dust town. He slightly changed the spelling of the word, and it means dust town the way he has it. So what he's saying is, in dust town, roll thyself into dust as a sign of mourning. And when people threw dust upon their head, put on sackcloth, that was a sign of mourning. So he said, don't let the Philistines know about this awful judgment. Don't tell it at Gath. Don't go over and weep in Weep Town. Don't tell it in Tell Town. But said, here in our own place, in our own country, said, roll in the dust in Dust Town. And so I guess the last thought in that verse is very good. We all sprang from the dust. Adam was made out of the dust of the ground, the Bible said. And to dust we all must return. Dust thou art, unto dust thou shalt return, the Lord told Adam. And you know, whenever the judgment of God comes upon us and all of that, it's designed to remind us that we are but dust. That God can reduce people to dust just like He can a city to dust. He completely destroyed the city of Samaria. He also later completely destroyed the city of Judah. So that Nehemiah and some of them had to go back in Ezra and rebuild that city. It was totally in ruin. So, don't tell it in Gossip Town. Don't weep in Weep Town. But in Dust Town, roll thyself into dust. What a play on words he has there. I'm sorry that we can't read it like it really is in the Hebrew. I'm sure it would be a very intriguing statement. But that's the best that we can do in English. Because what he really said was, don't tell it in Tell Town, and don't weep in Weep Town, but roll in the dust in Dust Town. And that in modern English is about what the prophet said, a most remarkable way of expressing himself. I'm sure that must have got the people's attention in that day, as well as it would probably hold your attention a little bit longer. And there'll be other words like this as we go on down here. And it is one of the most interesting parts of the book to me. And it is a play on words about all these towns. And so you'll look forward to the next lesson, I'm sure, because it will be the rest of these towns and what they mean and what he said about them. That's all for tonight. Let us stand and we shall sing.